Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Dope Black Dad podcast. My name is Marvin Harrison. I am here. Should we clap for that?
Again?
Every week.
You're asking for claps. The fact that you're having to ask for them. Like, it feels like
Why
a pity.
Why do you sound like one of those women's podcasts that hate when men do anything? Can I ask for claps? I'm breathing. Oh, when they breathed. Oh. It's all right, bruv. Yeah, I'm a loving man. What do you want me to be?
It was bloody misandrist.
Wow. I'm here. I don't know long words, women. So if he says something mean, he says something. Can you just zoom in? The guy in orange. I don't say things like that because I know better. I already told the line with what I just said. And in fact, I'll take it back. I'm sorry. Don't cancel my stuff. Right? Anyone? This week we are here today with Romantha Bota, who's our in-house woman to equalize the nonsense that we talk about, but also as an expert in broadcasting and production and Sex and Pleasure, which is your amazing documentary.
Yes.
Also, she keeps us all, she's like a teacher, she keeps us all governed, and she's doing the Vogue, in case you can't see the Vogue. It's offbeat, but it doesn't matter.
You're such a hater, man.
I know.
No, she's doing it to the Amapiano beat.
Wow. What? Stop doing African stuff. Don't you know, it really winds her up.
Oh,
every week you do African stuff, it winds her up.
Why have you not said anything?
Then in the car home,
I can't be racist. I'm African.
No, at all.
No, but you're West African, bro. You people are Brazzy, bro. You think you're the king of diasporas?
I think I'm trying to just get South Africa back for how they treat Nigerians.
Oh. Wow. That's a whole political topic. We'll bring in two South Africans and two Nigerians and watch the fight happen.
Whoa.
And we're also here with Darwood Grace, who is the in-house Black Jesus, a.k.a. Corruptor, a.k.a. person that we have to edit out the most.
Wow.
Yeah, but can I look? We can't make these things negative. Because it sounds negative, doesn't mean it is negative. Yeah,
okay, it's the way you phrased it.
Yeah, but that's the whole point of me as the host and broadcaster. It's meant to sound triggering, but not be. That's the whole point. Good to see you.
Good to see
Love
you
the colours.
Thank you, sir.
Ah. Also here we have Kalia. Kalia, how you doing? Is it Kalia Ishmael, right? I got it right?
Kalia is Maine.
Is Maine.
Yeah.
Sorry. Didn't read the brief properly. And by the way, it's right here. It's right here. Wow. I'm just going to say it's Lewis Holmes. How are you doing, Sace?
Nope. Sace Holmes Lewis.
See, it's wrong here.
Yeah. Well, I'll correct you. It's all good.
No, thank you. I'm glad you're here. Someone's got to do the job of getting things right. And basically, the worst thing is, it's not like I don't know, but I never actually consciously say your full name. So then I go stupid and I'm looking at you like, Sace. Like, and I know. So thank you so much for joining us. How are you both doing?
Good. Yeah, all good.
Very hot.
Sun's out.
It's very warm.
Yeah.
But can I just say, outside is less warm. So we're going to honor this particular moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to pretend that we're in Jamaica.
I like this.
Someone's bringing rum punch.
Oh.
There's
might
a sound,
these mugs,
an echo
know?
Of Buju Banton far away, but like in echoes, you know. Where are you from, by the way? What's your...
So I'm half English, and then my nan is Jamaican, granddad St. Lucian.
Oh, Jamaica St. Lucia, proper blacks. You know what I mean? Proper blacks, them too. Don't mess around. Because Jamaica is basically the king of the diaspora. Mm. So it's a really important thing that when I meet other Jamaicans, that I let them know that you are so important to representing blackness.
Thank you. I've taken that personally.
Yeah, no, because us three, we all have meetings about how we further Jamaicans in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think when we do have those meetings, it's interesting because I think for 3 million people, do you think about the impact that Jamaica has had around the world? Yeah, so like the fastest runners and like Bob Marley, the and best food.
Yeah.
And
like you said, some of the fastest.
Well, we have a couple of them. They're quite, you know, there's a couple of people that are quite fast. Asafa Powell, you know, there's a couple of them. Mm. But I feel Jamaica is number one. Nigeria is number two, but they had to have 240 million people to make it.
Cultural impact per person, capita, Jamaica is top of the world.
It might even mean
sugarcane come from there.
I don't know what that means. What does that mean in the realm of things? Are you saying people what? Because like we're sweet up?
Yeah.
Say Jamaica's sweet anyway. Yeah.
It was a compliment. A shady one.
We don't know. We let the comments decide. That's how we do things. Mm. So, Carlia, we actually did a... I don't know. You was a kind of hosting. Were you organizing? You had organizing energy. And you were on the panel with me.
Yeah.
So, a Found Divine event.
Yeah. So basically, Lloyd's Bank sponsored that event. So I was there because obviously I run the Black Entrepreneurs Program.
Oh, so you ran the bank. I was like, oh, sorry.
I'm joking.
The way I just looked at you with marriage in my eyes. Hey, I like money, you know. I don't know how to get it.
I don't think you'll get far. Carlia just heard you talking about babies and stuff, you know?
Yeah, but with the right partner, she'll get all the babies.
Okay, Carlia.
And as we move on.
You were.
You did that.
You did that part out as well.
I don't know, man.
I think there's two already. I'm counting.
Yo. Yeah, we have a count. Say two. Sorry, please continue your story,
don't
Carlia.
Don't encourage him.
So I was supposed to be... I was there as the sponsor. I was supposed to be just making sure things ran... according to plan, but the person who was supposed to be on stage with you...
Who didn't turn up again?
Jamelia.
Ah, Jamelia Donaldson.
Yeah, so she was in Birmingham. She got stuck in Birmingham. So I walked in thinking, I'm just going to have a chill Saturday, just like sit in the background, make sure it runs okay. And the organiser, the founder of mine, walked up to me and was like, can you do me a massive favour? And I thought they were going to ask me to go to the shops. So I was like, yeah. They were like, and then they started like really like nice to me. They've been really sweet. And they're like, you know, because obviously like you're an amazing person. Because of all this stuff. And I was like, oh, thanks. Like, what do you want? They're like, can you do the keynote speech with Barbin? And I was like, are you taking the piss? But I was like, yeah, sure. So literally like 20 minutes before you turned up, I got told that I was going to be on the panel with you.
I remember us both reading the briefing for the first time together and being like, right, so this is why we're here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that cause of... But you were brilliant. You were great.
Yeah, you were brilliant.
It went down really, really well. And I love it. I think my measure is always how many questions you get after.
Yeah.
That means people have been activated and they want to say stuff. What I always find awkward though, is at the end, you get beelined for and people want their whole problem solved by you right there. Right now.
Yeah.
It's a real commitment though, isn't it? In terms of Black business, you have to give way more than you are ever planning to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like since I started working for Lloyd's Bank, the amount of questions and people beelining for me has gone up 10x, which I don't hate it because it's like ultimately like, yeah, I'm the money woman. So obviously people are going to want to come and speak to me. But like, I've just had to come up with like a million creative ways to say that's not what I do. Like I don't just give money out.
Basically.
Like there are, you know, rules I have to follow.
It's like, I don't have it in my house.
Yeah, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
wait, can I have your number?
No,
just
cash on.
Yeah,
I can't just take
finance.
You to the ATM. Like that's not how this works.
Yo, all the finance bros must be on your case. It's like a headache, man.
Bros like passport bros.
Finance bros are men that wear like mock neck jumpers and Chelsea boots with like camel coloured like jackets, and they sometimes have a windbreaker underneath, and they just walk around and talk about investment and cryptocurrency really passionately at you and say that if you trade currency, your future will be sorted. And you're like, my guy, please, if you just don't leave me alone like right now.
How many of those guys have you got in your unread what's that list?
Investment, Bitcoin.
Yeah, a lot.
No, but you know what? This is the only place you can talk about this. Tell us how you feel. Can you give one piece of just what would your overall response to all of those finance bros be? And then you can just wrap it up right now. You have to say it one time.
Please stop emailing me.
And I know our editor is going to add a picture of a finance bro right now to visualize this. And editor, I love you for that. Thank you. Thank you for being that person for us. Also, look, very rarely, because I'm going to tell you how you came to my attention. This is a really important part. Yeah. Okay. So in 2020, there was a particular point where I think it was Sarah Everard, there was like George Floyd, it's like a mixture of things. And there was like a raising of the hand of like, who are the Black men that are good men? and your name kept on coming up. I was like, who's this guy that's competing with me, brother? As the greatest black man on earth. Competing, you know? What do you mean?
I'm unaware. I don't know what's going on.
Why is your name coming up next to mine?
Clearly a one-man competition.
In his mind.
It's like sleeping and being like, it's like for my sleep. But no, I think it's really beautiful when a man reoccurs or people reoccur. It means it's a really good sign in terms of like they're doing the right work long term as well, not performatively. And your name kept on coming up with different people. So I'm nosy like that. And that's actually a part of how I reached out to you also from Jammy as well. We didn't get to get into that. But like I just wanted to reach out to you and be like, look, I love what you're doing. It's great.
Yeah.
And we've kind of just been a quiet rumbling of consistently checking in. And then, you know, finally now I get you here, which is great. We can have a more extensive conversation.
Yeah.
Like you do work with young people. What actually would you define your complete mission as?
To bring communities together. That's really the main thing. I'm all about family and community. And that's the most important thing for me because I come from an estate, the Aylesbury Estate, and at the heart of it, even though there was
can
a lot of...
Can you contextualize Aylesbury Estate? Because it's like, when I mean it's world famous, it's world famous.
Aylesbury Estate is literally sandwiched between Peckham, Camberwell and Elephant and Castle, one of the largest housing estates in the whole of Europe at one point. Very diverse, a lot of issues in terms of people just trying to navigate life. But as I said, at the heart of it was a diverse and connected community. And that's just stayed with me. And with my mum being the influence on me that she is, I just wanted to give back, just like my mum. And I did that through my passion, which was football, initially as a coach. And I started coaching young people at the age of 16. So that then extended to education and things like that. So I've just grown. So I just want to bring communities together to really realise their potential.
And you've helped the careers of Reece Nelson and Jadon Sancho. What role did you actually play in sort of their development? Was it direct or was it just you just met them and knew them quite early?
No, it's direct. Reece lived on the Aylesbury Estate and him and Jadon were best friends. So they were always together. And every time they were together, they always had a football between them. But I came across Reece when I was scouting for the London Youth Games for Southwark Council. And that was at the age of 8. And I just couldn't believe the talent that I saw on that pitch from him and Jadon and a few others. And yeah, I became his coach from that age, from the age of 8 up until about 14 for the London Youth Games. But because he was on the estate and I did a lot of sessions on the estate, I always saw him, you know, every week. And I just built that relationship with him. And people think we're brothers or family. He looks quite similar. But yeah, I got so much love and respect for Reece and Jadon for what they're doing and what they're trying to do now in terms of giving back to the community.
Who are you more proud of? You can tell the truth.
Who am I more proud of?
Yeah,
like a favourite child.
Well, like, he's from the Aylesbury Estate, but I'm going to say Reece, but I'm not more proud of anybody. I just have a more close relationship with Reece because we've known each other for a long time.
It's a very political parental answer.
I used to see him on the estate when he was even younger because he lived next to my brother's best friend. And I saw this little boy, big head, running with the football all the time. He was like 3 or 4 and he always had a football at his feet. And I realised that was Reece, you know, and then coming across him. So, yeah, really proud of Reece and what he's done in his career and what he's doing in terms of giving back as well.
Powerful.
So, as Gunnar, please get a message to him. Just hang in there. I think that with an extended run in the team, he'll show everyone how good he is. Every time
you
I watch
say
him,
that.
He's a good quality player. And he's so underrated. Yeah.
Do you know what's really sad? Because I think the opposite. I think he needs to go.
If he goes, we'll see how much we miss him.
We will.
No. I agree with you. But you know, I think the one thing that Jadon did well is he left and went to a place where he could shine. Yeah. Well, sometimes it's not whether you're good enough, it's whether you have the platform to shine. And I think if he played week in, week out.
Well, that's the key thing for Jadon. That was really good for his development because he went and played men's football. And unfortunately, a lot of young players, they're at top clubs, they don't play that kind of football. So they need to go. Yeah. And he did it at a really pivotal age, at the age of 17. And when his dad spoke to me about the chance for him to go to Germany, I said, he has to go, you know, and you can see now going back to Dortmund how happy he is within himself. So it's all about the enjoyment, you know, understanding why you're playing the game. It's not for the riches, it's not for the cars, the women, nothing like that. It's about the pure essence of I love this game and I want to express myself. And that's what I love about Reece and Jadon and that crop of players from South London.
One of the things I want to talk about today is because I just have this massive thing that's been reoccurring for the last month on the podcast, which is about I would really like more black men 50, 60 plus that I can connect to and ask questions to about the next development of my life. Like, I'm just about to hit 40. I know that I look very young. Coco butter. But for me, I love the idea of like sitting down with someone who's 55 and they just be like, these are some things that I learned in my 40s to 50s. Like, I just observed and I was trying to do this and didn't really run. And one thing I learned, because I think that's a really important start part of the next step. And I think we was at the house, was it the kitchen conversation,
yeah,
or was it?
Yeah.
And we were talking.
No, it was the one before that.
It was the one before that, yeah, about, what's the guy, John Baptiste,
American
Symphony?
Symphony, yeah.
So we do movie nights at my house as well. So like when we do that, the topics came up and it was like me and my friend was like discussing quite passionately the desire for someone just a little bit older, just to drop game and just like keep us in that kind of check. I think the race part is really important, but I've had amazing mentors like at different points in my life. I feel like in school, I scraped through school. Like I didn't get it. I had no idea what this was contributing. And you know, we're like in school, they're like, oh, your future. And you're like, what future? I don't know what a future is. I'm barely making it right now. I come from a very like low income family. I'm living on a state where no one really does anything different or special. So what are you talking about future? This test means nothing to me. Mm. And it wasn't until I left and I met Carl Ramsey at 19 years old. And we used to do these things called verbal intercourse. So we'll sit in a circle of about 25, 30 of us, and we'll talk about a topic and talk about black love. And it will be like, we'll just dissect it in a way where everyone gets to contribute. And you hear what women think, what men think, what people from the LGBT community think. All of those things helped me gain true perspective and like develop values, actually, because they were being road tested in conversation. And so I had an amazing mentor then at 25, and met another amazing guy called Richard Antwi, who was like a music guy. He went to Oxford University, and he had a partnership company called Levels with EMI. And I was like, I'd never heard anybody that had a record label job. Like, Jobs was just about, but to have a company partnership, yeah, I had never met anybody that done it. And he knew everybody. He was a really good guy. I met James Samuel through him, loads of things. And so he's a really beautiful man. And since 25... you know, I've been pretty much on my own with it. Like, there's loads of people around me, but I think someone that in your life that you just get to quietly watch and observe and learn from. So for me, I'd love to hear who the people were in your life and what role did they play? Because I think that mentorship, that kind of like who saved you, who saw the good in you, who saw what you was different at, and what made you get to where you are. Because I think inherently, when you come from an inner city, the odds of you not making it are probably higher than making it. Like, I think the chance of you going to jail or, you know, dying or getting caught up in something, you know, untoward that just ruins your trajectory is easier than it is to actually come out and be healthily minded. So I don't know, and you're from South Africa, so I'd love to know if there's a South African version of like that, where you come from and the chances, or actually let's start with you. What is the context of growing up in George, and like who saw you and spoke life into you?
So I come from a council housing sort of, I would say, poor background. Mm. Very, very working class family, matriarchal home, one of those big houses where there's enough rooms for the daughters and their children. It's like a family house like that. And I think I mentioned this before, I was one of the only people who showed potential in school. Mm. My mom didn't finish school. Her siblings were not particularly academic. They did well to get by. My mom's younger sister finished high school. That's about it. Mm. And so in those times, I think it's about the same as you. You don't have people that are CEOs, that own companies, that's entrepreneurs. In fact, I didn't know what I wanted to do until I think maybe almost high school, because everything I saw in a book was like, how do I become that? I've never seen a doctor. I've never seen a lawyer. Yeah. I'm just reading about these things hypothetically as if they're fictional characters. And I think I wanted to become a tourist. I didn't actually know. You know why? Because my uncle was like a nomad. So he would just take off and he'd be away for months on end and come back with like the best stories ever.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, I want to do that. He couldn't sit still, but I actually thought he did like dope things. He probably came back and, you know, inflated stories and stuff like that, but I thought it was the coolest thing. You get to travel, you get to meet new people. I want to do that. And then I said, what do you call that you do? And he's like, no, I'm just a tourist. I wanted to become a tourist. And I think the equivalent for, you know, if you don't have a role model, you're most likely going to end up in jail or with, you know, in gangs or whatever, something like that, for men, for boys. For girls, it's ending up pregnant and just not making it out of that town. So for me, academics helped me. And there was a teacher in grade 7, Mr. Samson, who he was just so proud of me. He was like a dad, and I also didn't grow up with a dad. So he was like a father figure to me, and he would try and enroll me in like these private schools because he knows my family won't be able to afford it. But he's like, you can't just go to the local high school, which I ended up doing, by the way. And I did pretty, obviously excelled in there. But if it wasn't for him, who's like, you're not made for here. You're not supposed to just be here. That's in little Pakkelsdorp. And I'm incredibly proud to come from there because my entire community carries me. You know Facebook, you know, everyone is on Facebook. So when I started being on TV, every week there would be like clips and someone would tag me on Facebook. I'm like, oh my God, I remember you from school and stuff. So it's brilliant coming from those communities and making it. But you do have sort of like not survivor's guilt. Is it survivor's guilt? Yeah. That you're like, why do I, or remorse, like, why did I make it? And why didn't, for instance, Darwood, who we grew up on the same street,
his
parents
bum, had
the
failure. Crazy.
Parents had
idol. He hates working.
So like, why did I make it? And I don't know if you guys have the same experience, like from where you come from, and you see your peers and you're like, damn, you know, I don't know if it's luck or my mom's prayers. And I do know it's prayers and some sort of higher power that I'm not aware of, because it could have easily been me stuck there with four children and working at the local supermarket packing grocery bags, you know. And not to look down on those women who live those lives, but I knew that that wasn't for me. All because of Mr. Samson, who said, that's not for you. You're not supposed to stay here. So let me see how I can help you. So yeah, Mr. That's Samson, powerful. Big ups to you, man.
Shouts to him, man. Darwood, because you're a creative, like a true creative, and I always tell you, like, every time I see you creating, it's my favorite way that I see you express yourself. And I don't know what you tap into, but you come out with some sort of visual or communication that is just different. It's on a different frequency. It's really powerful. So that, I assume, when you were growing up, wasn't normal, like little black boys trying to create. When did it hit for you that maybe this is your way that you need to express yourself, versus like what the societal norm was, which is like take tests, become academic?
I actually was academic. I was extremely academic because my first forays into art, a teacher like discouraged me from and whatnot, like, and just, but my brain was too young to, instead of saying F the teacher, I said F art. I just left art. It was the only subject I played truancy on.
Really?
Yeah, but I excelled at everything, and I was going to become a doctor. And then age 16, my spirit just refused. Like, literally, I just couldn't. When, as soon as I got to college, I just couldn't get out of bed to go to college and whatnot. And like, and I used to think, what's wrong with me, blah, blah, blah. And then I ended up just linking creative people. And then I was like, oh, cool, let me try this acting thing. And I was doing it, and I excelled at that a little bit. And then I started directing. But funny enough, with speaking about mentors, my teacher, Michael Vance, again, like you, out of all the teachers I had, they all thought I was rowdy in that year. And I was one of the kids that used to get discussed in the staff room. Like, oh, that guy, he's done this today, he's done that. I was super rowdy, but I felt like my grades were helping the school a little bit, because I never got kicked out. Like, I used to get away with murder, like things that other people would get expelled for. I would just get sent home for a day or two. And it used to confuse me, like, okay, all right. And then Michael Vance was the first teacher that just was like, you've got something, stop messing about. But he wouldn't say it, he would just do things. So he brought Benjamin Zephaniah to my school.
Legend.
And that was the first time, like, poetry just seemed attractive to me, because when I thought of poetry, I thought of like them old, old bastard.
Seamus Heaney.
Yeah, them boring poets that just whine and moan and that. But he had his whole own cadence and that. And I remember just watching him and just being enthralled. And because of my temper, Mr. Vance goes, oh, maybe you should write some poetry when you're angry to write how you feel. And because I'd seen it, I was like, all right, cool. So that's how I started. And that,
within a few weeks, I was right, because I went to a boys' school, so none of us know how to talk to girls, but I could waffle. So I would start writing poems and selling them to guys for £5 and whatnot, filling in their Valentine's cards.
Love
putting SWALK sealed with a loving kiss.
Wow.
And then put your perfume on it. Like, I was coaching. This is the blind leading the blind. Yeah. I was coaching guys because I was a virgin. I was coaching guys on how to
Aren't
talk to
Aren't they the
girls.
Best, you know?
Yeah.
I had the best advice.
Wait, I used to sell this guidebook to guys for when you get a girl's phone number, you ask her this, and then you so I'll coach guys, you ask her this, and you ask her that, and you ask her that, but whatever she answers, that forms your next question. So I would teach them how to do it. So I'd be going through lessons.
That's crazy, man.
I know. So I was just doing wild stuff like that.
Does it work today?
Does it work?
100%. Anytime I coach a guy and I had to speak to a woman, it works.
Mm. So formula, you want to sell your formula?
What, to anybody?
Yeah.
I don't need, you've got a walking formula. You've got a walking formula. You don't need me.
You should, I think you should bottle that and sell that, man.
I should. But in terms of mentors, I have never had a mentor to say I'm going to mentor you or just take an active role. What I've done is I've taken on mentees, people that I watch from afar. And one I have to shout at, in fact two, Dean Ricketts and Charlie Dark. Like, they both became my mentors and they just did not know. Like, I just watched everything they did. And whenever I would speak to them, I would just bombard them with questions until like I got answers. And I knew they just ended up thinking, oh, that's a really weird kid. He's really intense. But, like, no, you were mentoring me. Now that I'm older, I've said to them, yeah, you know, you used to be my mentors. And that.
Wow. Carly, what was your journey going to be before someone interrupted it? Also, what role did your parents play? Were they down with it? Were they just like, I want to be a ballerina, and you're like, fine. Or I want to be a firefighter, and it was like, great. Or did they resist it?
Yeah, so my parents, very, very supportive. Not, they didn't understand what I was doing or anything like that, but they were just like, if you want to do it, like, we'll support you. But they, so my mum and all.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
My family, they're all teachers, public sector workers. My dad, they had other jobs, which are kind of, you know, just standard kind of office jobs. And
oh, it sounds like
they
were moving weight. I was like, oh.
You said that, that's
like, I know. I was like, let me clarify. They were legit jobs. They had pay slips. Like, yeah, all above board.
How underwhelming.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. My life was more boring than I was making out. But so in terms of kind of like, and I was always told, you know, oh, you're really smart. And you can do things. And I was like, great. But there was never really any clarification on what that would
is,
mean.
Yeah.
Like in the same way you were saying, oh, you wanted to be a tourist. Like legitimately, I wanted to be Beyonce. Like I can't sing.
How old are you, woman? What do you mean you wanted to be Beyonce? How old are you, man?
I'm 30. And so
you're a young pop.
Oh, wow.
Oh, please.
Jesus Christ.
I like the table. Yeah.
She's a woman. No, but the reason why I say that, though.
That was misogyny.
I don't know what that means. It's big words again. What reason why I said that? It's always good to be stupid to get out of accountability. What is that? I don't understand. I'm sorry. Yes, definitely not something I would ever do. But what's really beautiful about that is that Beyonce was like, I was an adult when Beyonce was an adult. So now you're making me feel way about you dreaming to be someone who was like my age. Feel weird now. But anyway, continue with your story with your drug dealing parents. Yeah. Go on.
So yes, I was always kind of like, yeah, I was smart, I was getting the grades, but I just didn't know what to do with it. But I always had the encouragement that, okay, well, when you work it out, like, you know, we kind of believe in you.
It's exactly the same.
Yeah, but I never had, like, no teachers really, like, intervene. Like, when you was naming teachers, like, I couldn't think of any off the top of my head that kind of did anything for me significantly. But there was a few that, for instance, like, they would see that I was looking at particular courses at particular unis and be like, you're not dreaming big enough. Mm. Like, why are you looking there? Why are you not looking at, like, Oxford? Or
it's literally
or
that, though.
Yeah, like, the small things. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay, like, why don't you do this? And, like, so that kind of encouraged me to just think a bit bigger because my world was small.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, even though I had the encouragement, I had the, you know, the intelligence, I couldn't, you can't be what you can't see.
Yeah. So where did the audacity come to, like, create Jammy, which is not a simple, easy thing? That was a huge beast.
So it actually wasn't from audacity. It was from what you were saying around, I wouldn't call it, like, survivor's guilt, but it was almost just like, I felt like I've had so many opportunities. If I've been given, like, intelligence and I've been given, you know, a bit of the gift of the gab or whatever, like, for me to just use it for myself is like, what are you doing? Like, it's a waste. And so I kind of was like, when, you know, the first wave of the Black Lives Matter movement happened and, you know, everyone was kind of reignited into kind of like looking at actually like what is happening to the Black community. Like, my family's always been very pro-Black. Like, when I was like 8, I got given this book on Black heroes, all American. But, like, you know, I was always told, like, you know, be proud of who you are, be proud of being Black British in particular. And, like, it was really kind of like drummed into me from when I was young. So when all this stuff happened in like 2013, 2014, I was like, I knew about this stuff. Like, this stuff's been happening for decades.
Yeah.
And so I was like, if I kind of saw it as a, you know, we've been talking about this, you know, the oppression of Black communities for so long, and still nothing has happened. Maybe, if, you know, I came up with this concept of you know, because we started off as a discount card for Black in business, and I thought, well, maybe if no one else is doing it, maybe I should just do it. Do you know what I mean? Like, see what happens. It wasn't even coming from an ego perspective, like, you know, I'll solve the problem.
But did someone speak life into you at some point and just be like, do you know what you could be doing? Or do you know it's actually possible? Or was it just literally just off your own?
No, it was literally just for me, it was like, I will regret it if I don't try. Like, if I try and I fail, it is what it is. At least I tried. But for me, I'm just like, I just felt like I've been given gifts, you know, if I don't do anything with them, that's just such a waste.
Yeah.
And who am I not to, not say serve my community, but like, you know, who am I not to give back if I've been blessed with being where I am?
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So that was literally how it started. But it was very much a case of when I did finally think to myself, okay, I'm going to start this business. I didn't know any entrepreneurs. I didn't know anyone. I started to reach out to people. Like, people like, you know, Jamelia, I was saying earlier, and they gave back to me. Like, she just started her business. And so she's not like she, you know, had lots of time and stuff. And she was like to me, right, come to this event and I'll introduce you to a few other people. And then that ball started rolling. Like, amazing. More and more people were just like, okay, you know, you're just a young girl. I was 22 at the time. I knew nothing. I was fresh out of uni. And more people were just like, you've sold me on the vision. I'm going to introduce you to someone. Introduced me to someone. And it was those people who then became like my mentors, the people who are ahead of me in the journey, who kind of were just so supportive of me. Even I was literally at dinner with her yesterday, like, and I think that was just really powerful for me because it just made me feel like, okay, I finally have people who I can look up to and who are showing me where I could go, because I think that was always what I was missing. Like, I kind of had, you know, had the belief, had the back, people was backing me, but backing to do what? I couldn't see it.
Powerful. Whereas, who made the Say story? Who were the main key players that kind of kept you from, obviously, an estate? Because by the way, that estate was not always peaceful. So who helped you navigate that? And then obviously to become this, and I suppose in a way, because you have a child who's like 17 years old. So I think you're also, you're coaching a man yourself. Like, who are the key people that gave you that code to get through it?
You know what? It's a combination. And I was very blessed to have people that stepped into my life at very, you know, critical times. So I think when my dad left the household at the age of 8, that's when a lot of my problems came to the fore in terms of just trying to figure out who I was. And then in the midst of living on that estate, which I said was very multicultural, but it was very white working class, especially on match days when we had Millwall games, you know, people walking through the estate, a lot of racism, things like that. And I started to think about who I was and then had a bit of an identity crisis to some degree, because I was thinking, well, no one's really spoke about my colour before and called me all these different words. So when my dad left, it just kind of further compounded those issues.
Yeah.
And all I wanted to do at that time, the first person that really inspired me to go after what I wanted outside of my mum was Ian Wright. So I saw Ian Wright and he became that distance mentor stroke uncle. And I wanted to play football. I wanted to play professional football. I wanted to play for Arsenal. Yeah. Football made me feel better because of the deficit I had with my dad being in and out of my life. So I really struggled with that, but I latched onto football. And then I realized my birthday was the same as Ian Wright, November 3rd. And then I was like, right, this is it. This is what I'm meant to do. Yeah. And football was accessible for us. So went to Kingsdale School, which was towards the outskirts of Southwark Borough, and I came across my first real mentor in education, a man called Devin Hansen. And Mr. Hansen was my head of year, but also the PE teacher, and he was just someone that he could tell you about yourself and you couldn't say nothing, you know. And it was just literally like, hold yourself. And he was Jamaican as well, and he just knew how to deal with the young people and my friends and everyone in the school. We got the respect of everybody.
It was the same as Michael Vance. He was a Rasta.
Yeah.
So not like he had jokes for days.
That was
no
it.
No one could talk back anything bad to him.
Like, yeah. Just that hard line and respect. You just knew if you crossed that line, it was a problem. So with Mr. Hansen now, he just really started to tell me, like in year 9, like, Sace, you need to start thinking about what you want to do. If you continue on this path, I've seen so many people go in this path, you're going to end up the typical young black stereotypical guy from a council estate. And by really latching onto football and utilizing that, you know, I really just changed my trajectory in year 10 and in year 11. And then I came across another mentor called Abdullah Ben Kamal. Everyone knows him as Abs or Ben, and he grew up on the Glebe estate in Peckham, and he founded a football club to support his young brothers from getting into gangs and stuff. And
I think I know his brother.
Who?
Rashid.
Yeah, Rex.
When you meet Rex, we'll talk after.
Yeah.
That's because I know as soon as you said the Abs, I was like,
So the Ben Kamal. So Abs gave his life to the community through football.
Yeah.
And he taught me a lot about life through the game and literally allowed me to believe that I could play professionally. And I wasn't where I needed to be. I wasn't putting in the required effort. So between 14 and 19, I really focused and he gave me that belief. And then I signed my first professional contract at the age of 19 in the Republic of Ireland. And that was because of his guidance and the support of Mr. Hansen. And they've been my mentors ever since. But I'm very, very lucky that I've had people that have invested time in their communities, but also helped me along my journey to reach my dreams. You know, I play professional football. I've represented Barbados internationally. I've coached some of the best players, you know, in England that England have produced. But outside of that, education was also paramount, and that was also for my mum and Mr. Hansen. So I really started focusing on educating myself as a coach and went back to education at the age of 28 to study at university, at the University of East London, and then studied youth and community work and sports development as a combined degree. And that gave me the inspiration to set up Mentivity and provide mentors for young people, because if we can do that and harness the energy of people giving back to other people's children outside of their families, that power is just true. You know, it's exponential. You don't be understanding what it did for me. It stopped me from going down the typical route, you know, with people that were doing negative things in my area, because I wanted money. I wanted these things, and that was viable and visible, and it was close, you know. But the other things, it was hard work. How do we do this? And people had to just sit me down and say, look, you're gonna have to do this to get to here. I'm like, well, I'm willing to do it, because I love this and I want to do it. So without Mr. Hansen and Abs, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today.
I have one more question for you both, is that you both do great work on behalf, well, it's like your vision, but it enhances the black experience for everybody. Is there a cost to doing community work? Like personally, like what do you lose on behalf of doing for others?
It's hard to switch off.
Yeah.
It's hard to say no. Like, for instance, like earlier I was joking about, you know, please stop emailing. But it's like, but you know, I want to help everyone. Yeah. I want to, you know, really live my purpose and, you know, support the growth of black owned businesses. And for that reason, I do find myself overstretched, operating beyond capacity, doing things where if I wasn't, you know, living within a purpose, for instance, I would just close my laptop and just, you know, move on. Yeah, it would be like 9 to 5, move on with my life type thing. Mm. And I think that has a real emotional cost. And over the years, so I've been running Jammy since 2016. Over the years, it's had a real emotional toll because you want to support. As you kind of get bigger and more well-known, more and more people will come to you and ask for support. And so, and you want to do more, but you're still just a person.
Yeah.
And you're still operating within the confines of reality. I don't have unlimited money. I don't have unlimited energy. I don't have unlimited resources. And emotionally, that it cuts into you. Do you know what I mean? And it cuts into who you are as a person sometimes.
I hear that. What about you, Sais?
Yeah, much the same. I echo a lot of the same sentiments. But I think burnout is the worst thing, because by not saying no, you get to a point where you have nothing left. And I experienced that in 2019, and I never want to be there again. And when you're at rock bottom, you realise, one, the people around you who care about you, but also you have to rebuild yourself, and whilst trying to still provide services for others. And you know, the work that we do in trying to prevent young people from going down the wrong path with mentivity is very difficult, and it's taxing. And when they do go down the wrong path and you lose young people, which I have, you know, I've lost 13 young people since 2008 that I've worked with extensively, predominantly in Southwark. And that
what does that do for your belief, though? Because I think belief was driving me for many, many years. Yeah. Like, I had a very pure, high-level vision of what I was doing and what I would like to see happen.
Yeah.
When life's and all these different variables kick in, you realise how much hard work that really is. And actually, you're better off preserving yourself to be a long-term, consistent voice rather than like try to explode into the answer. But what does it do when you like lose people? You're like, losing young people in the middle of you trying to help young people.
You toy with that idea, and I'll be real. You know, you start thinking whether I'm cut out for this, but also you got to think about the young people you have prevented from going down that path. So that far outweighs the 13 that I've worked with, and that's why setting up this organisation was so important, because there was only so much I could do as one person. You know, I was doing this work before I set up Mentivity in 2016. You know, it's been 8 years. I've been working with young people for 25 years, since the age of 16. So in different guises, within school setting, within pupil referral units, you know, as a youth worker, I've done it so many different ways. But it's so difficult when you lose young people, because you start to think, am I doing enough? But you can't shoulder the responsibility of losing that young person, because so many other people have failed them where you haven't. And you have to believe in yourself that you can prevent this from happening again. And you have to keep going. You know, you really have to keep going. And sometimes it actually reaffirms why you're doing this. And it's a horrible thing. But, you know, when I lost Raheem in 2018, that cut me deep, because I knew him since the age of 8. You know, I went to school with his mum.
Yeah.
And I didn't
Were there signs that something wasn't right, or was it just happening?
Listen, I knew from the minute I met him at the age of 8, I saw myself in him.
Right.
You know, I saw it. He was birthdays in October, same Scorpio like me, same demeanor. I was like rude, everything. I was just like, this is me. And I just latched onto him, and he latched onto me, because he needed that. But we just couldn't do enough. He was failed by so many other people in society. If he was with me, potentially he could have stopped that. But it's those personal connections, you know, and I felt like I had lost a son. And every time I lose young people, it feels like that.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just devastating. And even if I don't know them, it's just like, what are we doing? Like, if we don't have a society where we can't protect young people and protect women, we don't have a society. So we have to bring communities together.
Yeah.
It goes far beyond just young people. And that's why I just keep going and keep doing what I'm doing.
What is your outlook like? Like, I think about me, my whole thing was to evolve into boardrooms, into, you know, leadership positions, to look at how things are governed from that position. How would you describe yours? Are you still more frontline than boardrooms, or are you mixing and matching? Like, how are you finding that balance, and what's your out?
I would say, you know what, it's a sandwich approach now, because obviously being on the London Police Board and, you know, being a real advocate for young people's rights when it comes to policing, especially stop and search, I have to be in those rooms, but also be on the front line doing that work through mentivity, going to schools, doing assemblies. I have to be that person to showcase that I can be here, but also can be here. And this is something that you can actually create a career from. And I never knew I could do this, but I've had to really upskill myself and really put myself outside my comfort zone, you know, consistently by doing this work. And with some of the corporate support that we have, you know, Goldman Sachs, Spotify as well, you know, Foot Locker, there's so many different people that I'm speaking to, but I never thought I'd be doing this work. But I have to believe why I'm doing this, and the belief is every day is young people, you know, seeing them. And when I go to schools doing assembly, and they're like, now I'm going to do my work, now I'm going to be focused, that's why I do this, you know. So we have to be a combination, but the danger is that the more successful you become more detached from the reality. And I can't do that.
You know? That's really key.
Yeah.
Because what I never want to be is someone that's sort of standing aloft and being like, oh, black people should be doing this.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
So I've always kept really good proximity to the most, like, for me, the everydayness of what's happening for real black people rather than kind of what, reading it and giving a judgment. I have a...
That's got to be a fine.
That is a... Yeah, we've got to have a fine system, bro. Yeah. I do have... because I'm going to separate the room a little bit. I have a clip that I found. So this is like a section where the stuff that I find on the internet when I'm doom scrolling at 3 a.m. because I got so much work to do. And I found this clip and I want to play it for you and I want to hear, like, I have a question for you. Then I have a separate one for you too, because I think you've answered this before in a previous podcast, but I want to hear these ones. So this is the actual clip. And by the way, yeah, I've tried to have these conversations with my parents before and I realize it's fundamentally... waste time with all the love in the world, but this was really moving me because this guy was so angry and frustrated, and I'll try and show it to you while it's playing, but I'm going to play it into the microphone.
Just don't say that you've always created a comfortable environment to bring stuff up. You haven't, and that's straight up true, and I don't care if I'm going to get backlash for this, and I'm sorry that I'm upset right now, but I am upset because you keep constantly saying that, and that's completely false.
No, it's
you
haven't not
created,
false.
Yeah, it is, because you haven't created a comfortable environment to that level where I can come to you and talk to you about everything, and I'm telling you how I feel. You cannot tell me how I feel, Mom. This is the problem with parents. You can't tell me how I feel.
Then it's on you, because whatever I think that
I'm telling you right now, given the way you react towards certain things, the certain things that you say, the backlash, this comment, that comment, these toxic things that you say, you haven't created a comfortable environment 24/7.
Because those things are in your betterment.
Oh, my God.
If I say something, it's not out of the context.
Oh, my God. Okay. Parents have a 100% God-given right to say whatever the hell they want. You know what? If my kids get sent to an amazing school, you suck. You could have gotten to a better school. Oh, but I'm right to say that because you know what? It's in the betterment of that child.
No, they should not say
No. Mom, it's in the betterment of that child.
No.
So you just proved that it doesn't matter if it's in the betterment.
No.
If it's in the betterment of that child, does that still not hurt the child?
I never, ever say you
suck. No, I'm just giving you an example.
Just don't
say that you've always created...
Have you ever... try to, and I think slightly different question to you because you have a son.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried to have a conversation with your parents about anything big? Did it work?
No.
What has been your experience of, like, because now you're an adult.
Yeah.
And then now you're speaking to people who have raised you.
Mm.
And you're like, look, thank you for everything. You've been great. I get it. But here's like one or two areas that were really challenging. And you would just, probably a part of you is hoping that they just be like, do you know what? You're right.
Mm. Did I? No, I kind of have gone with the complete opposite approach, which is actually just accepting them as humans.
Mm.
And that, you know, I wake up every day thinking, I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. Like, you know, just like in life and whatever. Once upon a time, it dawned on me, oh my God, they probably think the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they've never been, you know, 60 before and they've never been whatever. And I think for that reason, I just see them as humans. And so I kind of, for me, there's no point. Like, especially like, you know, speaking to like my mum and my dad about, you know, when this happened when I was this age and blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't need that level of healing. I also don't need that level of stress to have that conversation with them now, to be quite honest. Like, I've got a fantastic relationship with the both of them where I feel like now the person that I am, I'm completely supported by them. And then in the areas where there are challenges, I've just grown to accept it, which might not even be the healthiest thing. Yeah. But I
don't really need tools that you've used to kind of get through it, because I think... Like, sometimes the advice that I give is, like, you realise that there's actually a process that goes through to get it. Like, it's not as simple as, like, you just have to get over it, because that actually is a process to get over it. Because at first there's a part of you that's like, look, I needed to be heard, or, you know, I wanted you to create justice for me and make me feel better about what I experienced. And then you're trying... Is that
That's
me?
That's a fine. Oh. Another fine. Oh, no.
It's my guy as well. Oh, Lord.
Who's the third one? Mine's
man.
On airplane. Mad
team, I put mine on airplane.
You know what? I turned my phone up to play that clip. That's why I have it. It's production issues. But do you have any tips for, like, how people can improve that relationship? Because it's more than just getting over it. I feel like there's some ground steps that need to happen for you to be able to be like, all right, I'm fine with what it is. It's a journey. It takes time.
Yeah, you know, what actually happened with me, it was completely by accident. I had a manager ages ago who went on this, like, self-help course or something. And she was like, it's great. You, I'm going to pay for you to go on it. And I was like, okay. It's got me like 2 days off work. So I was like, yeah.
I shall go.
Yeah. I was like, cool. And so I went on it, and my nan had passed away, I think the year before. And I was, really close to my nan, love my nan. And they kind of were really pushing on, your relationships with your parents and stuff. And so they were kind of saying, what's happened in the last year is, bringing up, is there any trauma or anything you want to talk about? So I wanted to talk about my nan, who's my dad's mum. And through that, they were like, well, what would you say to your dad? And at the time I was like, nothing. Like, it is what it is. Like, things got handled how they got handled. And they're like, no. But like, what would you say to your dad? And I was really being very like, I don't want to talk about this. Like, yeah, I don't want to talk about this. Like, everything is fine, blah, blah, blah. And I kind of like was basically pouting and was like, I refuse to participate in this exercise. And then I watched everyone else do it. And then I was like, okay, like, I'm a big girl.
Does this begin with an L, by the way?
What?
The thing you went on, the course.
No, begins with an I.
I think there's a cousin to it. I think I know what it is. Okay, cool.
And so basically, the exercise was basically, so I had to say to like the mediator or the person who's running it, like what I would want to say to my dad. So I kind of like started off by kind of being like, I wasn't happy with this and I wasn't happy with that. And then he started responding.
Yeah.
Like as what he thought my dad would kind of say.
Yeah.
And I was just like, and as he was responding, I was like, I actually understand you a bit more. So that, I think that really helped me to see my dad as a person, as a human. Yeah. Because like, people are flawed, like as your parents, like, do you know what I mean? But I never really took the time to actually think about how my dad responds to me as a person, because I'm the oldest child. Like, I can be very much, you can't tell me anything, like that type of stuff. And like, he's a black man. Like, he's used to being the man of the house. He's got like this, his oldest daughter telling him like, man of what house? Like, kind of thing. Yeah. And it kind of helped me realize, actually, he's dealing with me in the same way that I'm dealing with him. And if I approach our relationship from a more equal footing, especially at that point, I think it's like 25, like as two adults who are, we have a relationship with each other, we will probably get on better. And from that week, that moment on, that was the turning point in our relationship, where every time something happens, like, I just see him as a person. Like, today he called me, like, as I was walking into the office, and I was like, why are you calling me at, like, so early? And so I picked up the phone, and I was like, Dad, I've got to go. Like, I can't talk to you right now. And I locked off, because, like, literally my manager was staring right at me. And then I was just like, that was really rude, like, he was just calling me just to see if I was okay. So I called him back, and I was like, oh, I'm really sorry about that. He's like, no, I'm sorry to you, because I know what it's like when you walk into the office. And I was like, no, don't apologize, because you didn't know I was walking into the office that time. And he's like, oh, okay, well, have a great day. And I was like, you have a great day too.
I love that. Yeah. Sace, what about you?
Oh boy, I think from my perspective of my mum, I had a respectful fear of my mum, as a Jamaican strong woman, and she had to play the role of mum and dad. So for me, being the eldest, I made the most mistakes and needed the most discipline. So it was difficult for me to navigate and speak about the issues that I had, because I didn't want to burden her with my issues, to be honest. So I didn't want to add anything to her plate. But from my perspective now, as a father to a 17-year-old, I've continuously tried to make sure that, one, he knows that he can't be wrong for however he feels. And I think that's really important for me to keep that. He can never be wrong for how he feels.
Okay.
And I think that's really, really important. And he's a very emotional young person, just like me. But again, sometimes he has that respectful fear and doesn't think I'm going to be able to detach myself from being his dad to give him the advice or say the right things. And that makes it difficult. But also, it doesn't help that growing up on a council estate as well, you can't just be jovial and happy all the time with your face. Like, you have a resting bad man face. I'm literally, so a lot of people fear me and they haven't even spoke to me. And I just had this kind of like headmaster kind of, big brother thing that people think, oh, I can't talk to Sace, he's not going to understand. But I actually do. So I'm really trying to work on that and be
more.
Do you
ever use it as a defense maker, like as a weapon? Because I sometimes do. When I can't be bothered to engage, I just be as big and as black as I humanly can. Please leave me the hell alone.
My face just goes at that noise. It's default thing. But when I smile, I'm a totally different person. So I think it's really important to foster, safe environments for our young people and our children, because I have to be consistent with him to get to the point that he can speak to me the way I would love for him to speak to me. But he speaks to my wife a lot more than he does me. But and I'm like, oh, I found this out. I'm like, but then I just go back to him like, oh, you didn't tell me this.
Yeah,
and
he'd
be
like,
oh, sorry, but I'll tell you next time. So I think we just got to make sure that we are consistent with our young people and model the behaviours that we expect to see in them. Ourselves.
Yeah. Powerful.
Was that always the case in terms of setting up a safe space for him to talk, or did you have to learn it?
Always, from a young age, especially working with young people, I learned a lot, you know, as a practitioner, as a youth worker, I learned a lot, and I never wanted young people to, my son to feel uncomfortable around me. But that's just natural because I'm his dad, you know, he's got these expectations that I'm going to have these expectations on him, but I don't, you know, I'm just like, you've got to figure it out, you know, and I just want to be there for him, you know, when those things go wrong, more than when things go right.
Yeah. Well, look, I think we're actually out of time, but I do want to ask everyone one really quick question. Yeah. And it's one I always ask when I'm gathering people, and it takes reflection. So take a second if you need to, but understand we have to be out of it in 4 minutes. It's the one thing that's currently happening in your life that is unwanted, but it just keeps happening. So the question is actually phrased, what's unwanted but persists. But for me, the question of something that keeps happening that you're just trying to stop, a habit that you keep on breaking. Ro.
Getting triggered by my mom.
Suicidal thoughts.
Man.
I know. I can't get rid of them. But I'm arming myself, basically, so I don't hit rock bottom.
Yeah. Anchoring is important. I love you. You know that, by the way.
Cheers.
Carly.
Thank you for sharing that, bro.
Yeah. Lack of discipline for me.
And which area is the discipline lacking? All areas or just a particular area? The finance bros in your DMs.
Yeah. No, all areas. I think because at the moment I'm balancing Jammy, stuff with Lloyd's Bank. I'm buying a house. I've become a school governor. For some reason, I keep piling things on. And
lack of discipline was the furthest thing from my mind.
So I need to be just generally like more disciplined, more organized, and more strategic with the things that I'm doing and the prioritization of these things as well.
Not being all things to everybody. And I think that's really important because you can spread yourself way too thin and then you don't achieve the things that you need to. And then it's like a cycle. You start feeling that, oh, I can't do this. But just understand that some people just can't be helped.
Yeah.
And that you have to invest that time in yourself to be able to help other people in a way that they may need, and those that are pouring into you so you can pour into them. So it's not that misplaced energy. I think that's really, really important. I've really worked on that the last 4 years. So that's a constant theme that's coming up.
My therapist once told me that you need to have a capsule of care, and she's like, five people can fit on this capsule. Who's in it? And she was being quite bullish with me. I was like, well, I have two kids. That's two spaces. But I think that was really good in terms of choosing who I can show up for 100%.
Yeah.
And some people just can get things and sometimes they can't.
Yeah.
And I think that really helped me sort of navigate that space, which is really beautiful.
So before you go, your persistent thoughts.
What is the persists? I'm very disciplined this year. Nothing has reoccurred yet. But I think, again, very similar, overcommitting. And also starting way too many businesses I have to stop. I have an idea a day and I feel like 50% of them I have a duty to start. And I really either need to continue or I need to cut them off. So I did a lot of culling at the end of last year. And that's something. I'll make that the thing. I cull my new initiatives that I need to stop. Cool. Thank you, everybody. Carly, I wanted to ask you, like, is parenting an aspiration of yours? Is it not yet too early? Do you secretly have a child because you're a governor now? I don't know why. About human beings that you created.
No, I don't secretly have a child. Not that I'm aware of. No, I definitely do want to be. Yeah, I definitely do want to be a parent sometime soon. But I just need to, like, all the things that I'm working on, I think I need to kind of get them in line first before I then add a new top priority on top of that.
Do you want to do a quick advert? We have men that watch this and maybe they'll just be a great little mini advert like I am.
Yeah, I'm getting a house, guys.
You know what you should do, though? Because I heard this woman made her boyfriend pay rent in the house that she owned and didn't
that
tell
was
him.
So cold.
And I thought it was so genius but brutal. I was like, it hurt my feelings, but I also was like, good for you. But like, that's quite harsh, but good for you. The poor man just paying rent and didn't know. But thank you, everyone, for coming. My name has been Marvin Harrison. We have been joined by Sace Holmes Lewis.
There you go. You got it, bro.
Damn. Carly Ishmael.
Pressure works, man.
Ishmael.
Very close.
Darwood Grace and Romanta Boata. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. This has been Dope Black Dads. Please email us because we're lonely and sad and we don't have any friends. hello@dopeblack.org. Can you follow us on Instagram? We're very near to 200,000. It's been a couple of months. We've been hovering around there precariously. Also, you can go to us on TikTok where we are gaining rapidly. And I'm on there now saying things, which I'm also growing quickly as well. I have a future as an influencer. So, thank you so much for joining us. And definitely we'll come back again. We'd have to have you back, obviously, because we have loads. We didn't even go into black business fully. But yeah, you know what I mean? There's loads of stuff, mate.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.